You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. We love the herb. It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Monday, November 13th, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Thanks for joining us here as we get to the last few weeks of 2017, and this week is going to be an abbreviated week for the daily podcast here, because on Wednesday I fly off to Las Vegas, Nevada to take part in the Marijuana Business Conference, the MJ BizCon, the largest expo of cannabis in the world. There's going to be over 650 different vendor booths at this event. I'll only be able to cover it for Thursday and Friday, so we'll see how many I can get to. We'll bring back as much audio as we can from this amazing example of the Green Rush in action. So we'll have shows today, tomorrow, and Wednesday, and then I'll fly out Wednesday night. Also this weekend, coming up on Sunday, is the Oregon Marijuana Business Conference. I'll be there in Ashland, Oregon, taking part in that event. I'm also going to be interviewing one of the most influential state senators in Oregon, Senator Floyd Prezansky, in a special one-hour on-stage interview. Follow me on Facebook. I'm Radical Russ on Facebook, and follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, and we're going to see if we can stream live that event. And I'm not exactly sure if I'm streaming it from the page or streaming it from my Radical Russ account, but I'll try and figure that out and tell you on tomorrow or Wednesday's show what exactly is going on. But coming up on today's show, following our cannabis headline news, we'll get into our What in the News segment. And boy, I got to really lay into President Trump and what's going on with the Philippines, where he just recently met with the brutal dictator there, Rodrigo Duterte, the president of the Philippines. We'll talk about that in the news and in What in the News. On today's show, being that it's Monday, it's time for us to visit with Dr. Mitch Earlywine from the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in our Cannabis Q&A segment. We've got a lot of studies to talk about, and one of them has to do with endocannabinoids and sex. And speaking of sex, we'll talk about the Supreme Court in the Radical Rant today and the various cases that define sexual privacy and ask, why don't any of those cases apply to marijuana privacy? Now let's get to the news.
This is your Cannabis Headline News, brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net, the complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your Cannabis Headline News for Monday, November 13th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. The Garden State could be enjoying 420 a whole lot more next year, as marijuana legalization could be passed in New Jersey as soon as April or May. Newly elected Governor Phil Murphy, a Democrat, comes into office having promised to enact legalization, a 180-degree turn in policy from outgoing Republican Governor Chris Christie, a fierce supporter of maintaining prohibition. State Senator Nick Scutari, a Democrat and chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, made the prediction in a story from The Observer. Scutari currently has a bill that would legalize possession of an ounce of flower, 16 ounces of infused products, or 72 ounces of liquids, as well as 7 grams of concentrates. Scutari's bill would maintain the prohibition on home cannabis cultivation. Taxes on legal cannabis products would begin at 7%, rising up to 25% over 5 years. Scutari also alluded to an early sales program through existing medical marijuana dispensaries, borrowing an idea from Oregon's recreational marijuana rollout. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed into law a bill that adds post-traumatic stress to the list of qualifying conditions for medical cannabis. The bill was one of 5 bills included in a package of laws designed to aid our nation's veterans. Quote, "Our veterans risked their lives in order to defend the ideals and principles that this nation was founded upon, and it is our duty to do everything we can to support them when they return home," end quote, Governor Cuomo said on Saturday in Albany at a ceremony commemorating Veterans Day. Continuing, quote, From improving access to healthcare treatments and services to removing barriers to employment, all five of these bills take important steps to ensure that veterans have every opportunity to continue succeeding when they return home, end quote. The other four bills add additional paid leave days for state-employed veterans to seek health care, waive the civil service exam fee for honorably discharged vets, create a chair and plaque in the state capitol honoring POWs and MIAs, and create a public list of nonprofits soliciting funds for the armed services. U.S. President Donald Trump failed to address the horrendous drug war slaughter in the Philippines as he met today with Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders claimed that the U.S. president spoke briefly to Duterte about human rights in the context of fighting illegal drugs. However, Harry Roque, the spokesperson for the Philippine president, said, quote, "There was no mention of human rights. There was no mention of extra-legal killings. There was only a rather lengthy discussion of the Philippine war on drugs, with President Duterte doing most of the explaining," end quote. Human rights advocates believe over 9,000 Filipinos suspected of drug use and dealing have been executed by police and vigilante gangs who've been given the go-ahead by Duterte, who bragged last year that he personally shot three people and bragged last week he first killed a man at age 16. Earlier reports of the so-called Jamaica coalition government of German Chancellor Angela Merkel forging ahead with marijuana legalization may run into a potent opponent, German public opinion. In a new poll released by research institute Forsa, 63% of Germans oppose the legalization of cannabis for adult use, with just over one-third, 34%, supporting retail access to cannabis for all adults. While 56% of men surveyed agreed with maintaining the current prohibition, far more women, 70%, support the status quo. The only group found in majority support for legalization are the supporters of the Left Party at 55%, the Greens at 46%, and the Alternative for Germany Party at 41% also showed greater than average support, as did people under age 30 with 43% support. If Donald Trump's proposed border wall with Mexico is supposed to stop drugs, it's going to have to be fairly tall. That's because officials in the border state of Sonora have seized a modified van containing a homemade air compressor cannon designed to shoot bundles of marijuana over the border like an NBA mascot firing T-shirts into the crowd. Over 1,800 pounds of marijuana in over 200 packages was seized from the van. Ingenious smugglers have also used catapults and trebuchets, forms of medieval siege weapons, and unmanned aerial drones to hoist drug bundles over walls, as well as tunnels dug under the walls to transport contraband. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Monday, November 13th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. If you appreciate my full-time dedication to reporting and analyzing the news about cannabis, consider becoming a patron of the show. For just $4.20 per month, you'll help keep my live stream and podcast free while earning yourself your own private ad-free podcast link for the show, as well as links to the supporting articles and data. For a $9.99 VIP subscription, you'll get all that plus my exclusive research, data tables, and graphics. Just log on to mjagenda.com and click the Become a Patron button today.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
It's like I picked the wrong week to quit smoking.
Learn more at mjagenda.com.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal potland Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House. Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159855.
People can say no to drugs.
It's really, really easy.
Adding more gasoline to the fire.
Lackadaisical.
Really tough, really big, really great
to infect and rot our nation.
Dangerous and gateway drugs.
We don't need to be legalizing marijuana.
To build and grow a stronger, healthier, and drug-free society.
What, in the news?
Let's take a look at the stories that we reviewed in the cannabis headline news, starting with the story in New Jersey, where the legislature is poised to pass a bill to legalize marijuana, one that they've been working on in the past and have passed in the past, but always ran up against the roadblock of Governor Chris Christie, who said marijuana would not be legalized on his watch. Well, the good news is that Governor Chris Christie's watch is over, and the incoming governor, Democrat Phil Murphy, promised to enact legalization. The only problem we've got here with New Jersey is, once again, it being the no garden state. They saw that with medical marijuana. They brought medical marijuana into New Jersey in 2013, I believe it was, and refused to allow patients and caregivers to cultivate their own cannabis for medicine. They're repeating that mistake with marijuana legalization, refusing to allow cultivation to become legalized, maintaining the prohibition on cultivation. And if there's one thing that we've learned from Washington State in its continuing ban on home cultivation is, A, it doesn't work. It does not work. For anybody out there that's got a problem with the no home grow legalization, keep in mind that maintaining the prohibition on cannabis cultivation, but taking away the police's easiest methods of trying to prove that, is still a good deal. It's still quite a good deal. I know plenty of people in Washington State who are home cultivators who no longer have to worry so much about the complaints of smell that they had to deal with before, and some of the probable cause that could be used. If you caught someone, say, for example, with a baggie of weed in the past, you could find out where they got it from, work your way up the chain, find the person who home grew that. That's not an option anymore for the police. So in the long run, I guess I should say in the short run, it's still a decent move in that the people home growing in New Jersey will have a better chance of getting away with it. And their customers, if they are selling to people, and that's the way a lot of marijuana sales go, folks, is from the grower to their friends. This is going to be easier as well, as the possession of that cannabis will be legal. But in the long run, they're going to have to do something about home cannabis cultivation. This continuing standard that we're seeing unfold in some of the medical states and now in these ideas for legislative legalization that ban home grow just put us locked into either purchasing from corporations or purchasing from the black market. And when it comes to the corporations, we've already seen that they're going to have a 7% tax that's going to rise all the way up to 25% tax. And all that does for us is provide a incentive and a price subsidy for the people that are growing illicitly to continue having their customers. The problem on the other side, though, buying from that illicit market, you don't know what you're getting. You don't know if it's been treated with pesticides. You don't know what potency it is. You don't have any guarantee of what strain it really is. This idea of legalizing without home grow is also countered on the other side by states like Vermont that are looking at legalizing with home grow, but having no commercialization. The problem both of these states are trying to solve is one that cannot be solved through legalization in their state. They're both worried about the black market. New Jersey is figuring, well, we can't have people home grow because that'll feed the black market. And Vermont is worried about the commercial market. We can't have a commercial market because that will entice people to smoke weed, right? Neither of these states understand that what's going on here is cannabis policy is not something that can be contained within the borders of a state. So long as prohibition exists in other states, there will be a grand financial incentive to grow that weed and smuggle it out of state, buy that weed and smuggle it out of state, no matter what sort of system you build. There is a very good reason we don't have an extensive network of people homebrewing beer and smuggling it across state lines. Because anybody in any state, even states that have dry counties, anybody in any state can easily access beer. There is no profit in having an extensive home-brewed beer smuggling market. There will continue to be a profit motive in the home-grown cannabis smuggling market in Vermont, in New Jersey, in any state, until we finally get the end of cannabis prohibition nationwide. Now, the other what in the news that I definitely wanted to bring up was Trump. He's on this visit to Asia, this 12-day tour of Asia, and today he was in the Philippines meeting with Rodrigo Duterte, the murderous, brutal authoritarian. And, you know, Donald Trump has never met an authoritarian he didn't like. I think he's jealous of them. I think Trump is jealous of guys like Duterte and Erdogan in Turkey and Putin in Russia. He's jealous that these guys can shut down the media, can jail their opponents, can, in the case of Duterte, order extrajudicial killings of suspected, not convicted, suspected drug dealers and drug users. And it was reported earlier this year, in the summertime, there was a phone call between Duterte and Trump, and it was reported that Trump said that Duterte was doing a great job on his war on drugs. A great job. This great job that Trump is talking about is the killing, the slaughter of over 9,000 people, the packing in their prisons of 60, 70,000 people for prisons meant to hold 10, 20,000 people. People turning themselves in. I'd rather go to prison than face a wandering death squad of cops or vigilantes or both wandering the streets, shooting people, killing people they think smoked a joint or did some ecstasy or cocaine or whatever other drug it might be. Trump today met with Duterte and did not criticize him or bring up the drug war slaughter. Now, his press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, said, well, they talked about human rights briefly in the context of illegal drugs, but the spokesman for the Philippines said, no, there was no mention of the killings, no mention of human rights. It was mostly Duterte talking and Trump listening. Duterte gets to get away with this. He has bragged about this. He's bragged about pushing people out of helicopters to their deaths. He's bragged about killing people as early as when he was 16 years old. He's bragged when he was mayor, 3 years ago he was mayor of some city before he became president, bragged of pulling the trigger himself, killing three people. But it's not too surprising. I mean, this goes along with Trump failing to condemn the moves of any authoritarian strongman. He's failed to condemn Vladimir Putin for his interference in our 2016 election. He went this weekend and contradicted the numerous unanimous views of our U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia interfered in our election, saying, oh, I believe Vlad. I believe. Can you imagine Trump facing down Khrushchev during the Cuban Missile Crisis? Oh, Nikita says there's no missiles in Cuba. I believe him when he says that. It's remarkable, but it's not surprising. It's not surprising. He wouldn't face down Putin. He didn't face down Erdogan. That Turkish strongman, Erdogan, when he was in Washington, D.C. a few months back, there were some protesters in Washington, D.C. protesting him, and Erdogan sent his bodyguards out to rough up the protesters. In America, in Washington, D.C., Turkish bodyguards beating down American protesters on our soil. And Trump had nothing to say about it. So that Trump didn't have anything to say about a murderous drug war dictator is hardly surprising. I do like the news, though. I did like this final story about the air cannon shooting the bundles of marijuana over the border, right? I mean, Trump himself, there's that famous clip of him talking about building the wall and said, there's no way we'll build a 30-foot wall. There's no way they can get over it. Well, unless they have a 31-foot ladder. He even said it. So you're going to build a wall to stop drugs when they can use a catapult, a trebuchet, an air cannon, an unmanned drone, aircraft, and tunnels, of course, dig the tunnels underneath, and even submarines. They make submarines now, homemade submarines in the jungles of Colombia to ferry cocaine up into the United States. And you think you're going to build a wall to try to stop that. Look, there's really only one way to stop the flow of drugs over any border, and that is to make sure there is adequate access to those drugs within the border. People want their drugs, whether that's cannabis, caffeine, or candy, whether it's cocaine or meth or ecstasy. People want their drugs,
And so long as there is, they are illegal, we will continue making a prohibition price subsidy that makes it far more than profitable for people to cross a border, climb a wall, or dig a tunnel. Only legalization will solve this problem.
One major responsibility is to encourage people to use less drugs.
Boy, isn't it kind of sad how President Trump has made George W. Bush look so much more presidential? Yeah, kind of like how an atom makes a dust speck look huge. It's 20 after. We got to take our safety briefing. When we come back, Dr. Mitch, we're going to talk about sex and weed. Hi, I'm Russ Belville. Join me as I cover the marijuana agenda at the Oregon Marijuana Business Conference the weekend of November 18th and 19th in beautiful Ashland, Oregon. The OMBC is Oregon's biggest and longest-running conference dedicated to the cannabis industry and marijuana activism. You'll hear an extended interview with influential state Senator Floyd Prezansky, a VIP reception and keynote address from the legendary Henry Rollins, and a free after-party featuring music from Hieroglyphics and Souls of Mischief. Plus, you'll get information from 40 industry exhibitor booths and be able to question members of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission regarding cannabis issues they'll be ruling on. Visit OregonMBC.com to learn more and book your tickets now. That's OregonMBC.com for the Oregon Marijuana Business Conference. We'll see you there.
The marijuana agenda, like the pharmaceutical agenda, without all the side effects, overdose deaths, you know, insurance.
Side effects may include nausea, dry mouth, and constipation. Dry mouth, constipation, indigestion, and abdominal pain.
Which can occur without warning and may cause death.
The Oregon Marijuana Business Conference, the state's longest-running conference dedicated to the cannabis industry, is coming to beautiful Ashland, Oregon on the weekend of November 18th and 19th. You'll hear from influential state Senator Floyd Prezansky, meet and greet with industry pros and the legendary Henry Rollins, and enjoy a free after-party featuring music from Hieroglyphics and Souls of Mischief. Visit OregonMBC.com to learn more and book your tickets now. That's OregonMBC.com for the Oregon Marijuana Business Conference. Now, in the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Marijuana Agenda presents this anti-drug public service announcement.
Drugs. I stop. You shouldn't start.
This has been an actual anti-drug public service announcement. To combat this and other drug war hysteria, listen to the Marijuana Agenda every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific at live.mjagenda.com. The International Cannabis Business Conference is headed to Hawaii. Get your tickets now for the year's best cannabis industry island retreat this December 1st through 3rd. Kauai Grand Hyatt hosts the three-day ICBC, which begins with a VIP reception featuring cannabis comedian Doug Benson. The ICBC features exhibitor booths, keynote speeches, and informative panels with industry experts and regulatory officials. Then, when it's all said and done, kick back for the incredible after party with music by reggae legends Morgan Heritage. There's also a singles golf tournament you can play on Monday, sponsored by Leafly Endured Ventures. Log on to internationalcbc.com to get more information and buy your tickets now. Special discount hotel rates are in effect, so act fast. That's internationalcbc.com for the International Cannabis Business Conference. Aloha.
The marijuana agenda, like the liberal agenda, but with profits. Ka-ching.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. If you're a cannabis brand looking to build trust and awareness within the community, consider becoming a sponsor of this program. Your message will be seen and heard by the most dedicated followers of marijuana policy reform, who are loyal and supportive of those brands that give back to the community. Just log on to MJAgenda.com and click the Become a Patron button to learn how your brand can also be featured in my live nationwide appearances. Thank you for your support.
This is Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Earlywine is a professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and author of numerous books and columns on cannabis science, culture, history, and medicine. Email your questions to Dr. Earlywine at 420research@gmail.com or call the Marijuana Agenda message line at 650-LEGAL-MJ. Now, here's your Cannabis Q&A.
All right, folks, it's time for another edition of our Cannabis Q&A, and we've got Dr. Mitch Earlywine here from the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Dr. Mitch, welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
Well, we're heading into the holiday season, and there's a big banquet, a cornucopia of cannabis studies for us to get to. Let's just jump right into it with the lead study here, the one on, this is a very interesting study, masturbation to orgasm stimulates the release of the endocannabinoid 2-arachidonolalalala. I can't even say it, Dr. Mitch. What is this study, and what are we talking about when we talk about 2-AG?
So 2-AG is a cannabinoid that's already in your body and tends to, you know, dissipate a little quicker than THC, but it's a really good agonist for that CB1 receptor. And it's clearly got a lot to do with pleasure. And what a surprise if folks in the lab are willing to go ahead and give themselves the most pleasure possible. We do see increases in 2-AG in their systems. I gotta admit, it's kind of a nice confirmation of something we may have all always suspected, and the fact that they had the money to do it was really to their credit.
Yeah, exactly. So what this is telling us then is that the 2-AG, this endogenous cannabinoid we have, is somehow contributing to or controlling or moderating the sexual response in humans.
It wouldn't stun me if it's actually released in response to sex. They didn't, you know, get to work out the timing in part because it's a very difficult system to monitor. But clearly, it increases when pleasure increases. So I think we can definitely count on that. I do think that some of the, you know, cannabis aphrodisiac legends may be loosely related to that, and the idea that the endocannabinoid system really does seem to enhance pleasure in a bunch of multiple domains makes this not a big surprise, but a neat thing to confirm.
All right, for our next study, this is one I believe the folks at Americans for Safe Access had something to do with this, but a study that comes out showing that of the online CBD marijuana extracts that they took a look at, almost 7 out of 10 of them were mislabeled as to how much CBD content they had in them. I was wondering if you took a look at that and what were your thoughts?
Indeed, our buddy Marcel Bond Miller has been involved in this. And, you know, the whole idea of selling CBD across 50 states seems to be going okay as long as we, you know, emphasize that there's no THC inside there. It's unfortunate that these are mislabeled, and some of them are clearly underlabeled. So the idea that you're going to get 10 milligrams and, in fact, you only get 7 seems like a bit of a ripoff. And folks who are kind of counting on cannabidiol to help them with anxiety or, God forbid, a seizure disorder really do need to have these things labeled appropriately. So we got to get on top of this as far as regulation is concerned. In truth, they are making a big deal about the ones who had more than they claimed they have, but CBD is not psychoactive and really, except in really large doses, and hardly toxic in any way. So I don't feel like that's big an issue. But with only 30% or so really, you know, being right on the money, I do hope we can get better control on these in all the companies who are providing CBD across the U.S.
Yeah, I'm sure nobody out there is complaining you got too much CBD for the dollar. I think that the over label will be okay, but it does underscore, like you said, the lack of consistency that regulation would bring to a market like this. All right, let's take a look at the effects of marijuana legalization. Of course, we've got 8 states now that have passed adult use cannabis laws. Things are looking very promising in the state of New Jersey with their new incoming governor. And there's a few other states that are looking at this. So there's 2 studies I wanted to get to. And this first one had to do with the marijuana usage by teens. Now, we've looked at other surveys and studies, and they've all pretty much concluded that, you know, teen use didn't go up in the legal states. But this study has a particular line in it that vexed me. And it was that they claimed that the decline in use of cigarettes and alcohol are to blame for the decline in use of or the steady, you know, the non-changing factor of marijuana use in teens, and that kids that weren't alcohol and cigarette users actually had an increase in marijuana use. It's the first time I've read a claim like that, and I was wondering what you thought.
So to tell the truth, I'm afraid this may be just some statistical hand-waving where they had to try to find some way to say that teen use was up in some subset of teens, and applying this kind of weird substitution method where folks who aren't using alcohol or cigarettes are somehow turning to cannabis or something like that. When you take a good look at the percentages, it's really not very big. And we've had so many repeating surveys essentially showing no changes in response to ending prohibition that I don't want to make too much of this. I should emphasize that deep down, if you are a teen, you're going to use something. Cannabis is certainly markedly less harmful than any of the other things we're talking about here. So if it's going to happen, this is the thing to happen. And again, we're talking about use here, not problems, not problematic use, not respiratory irritation, not dependence, not driving high. So again, even if there was a modest increase in a small subset of folks, it's certainly worth it to end these ridiculous wastes of police and court time in order to have this happen.
One of the aspects of that figure, of the unchanging teen use figure I'm referring to, that has vexed our opponents, Dr. Volkoff, I'm thinking, is one of them, was that the teen use didn't change, but the perception of risk decreased. That is, kids find cannabis to be less harmful than ever, but that doesn't cause them to use more. What are your thoughts on that?
That was wild, because really for about 3 decades before then, the correlation between perceived risk and use was often around 0.3. So the less harmful you thought cannabis was, the more likely you were to use it. I think now, to tell the truth, our teens are more educated about cannabis than ever. And it's delightful to think that they can know it's not harmful and still decide, you know what, it's not for me.
And the other aspect of legalization we wanted to take a look at was this study or a survey, I believe, on the outcomes for substance abuse treatment among adolescents in Colorado. Now that they've legalized marijuana, one of the fears was there'd be more kids in rehab. It would be harder to get them through rehab. But what does this study show us?
It's intriguing because they've been running these treatment organizations in Colorado since way before legalization and now way after, and really have enough data to draw some conclusions. If there really was a change post-medicalization or post-legalization, they would have been able to pick it up. They did all the crazy sub-samples. What about just the boys? What about just the youngest? It really just isn't happening. And the truth is, if teens want cannabis, they can get it. And so the bottom line is, pretending like there's a prohibition that's really helping teens is kind of faulty, and we're finding that in response to treatments, particularly psychological treatments that rely upon a teen's own motivation, we're going to have really the same rate of abstinence regardless of whether prohibition is out there sort of wasting people's time or it's really not there at all.
Is there any concern that what we're seeing with the flat rate of teenage use post legalization, is there any concern that that may be a delayed statistic, that perhaps years from now we would see an increase that is owable to legalization? And if so, if we did see a teen increase, what would our response be as activists when the opponents come back and say, aha, see, told you so?
It's funny because it's such an unfalsifiable thing. There's really no way to say how long that should last. And in fact, I think as activists, we can always emphasize that will educate people better in order to make sure that this doesn't increase or improve or somehow, you know, last for a long time. Because if we haven't seen it by now, odds are high we're not going to see it. And if 5 years from now we suddenly do see it, we can go ahead and intervene by improving our prevention efforts.
All right. And our final study for today is a look at the knowledge and perception of medical cannabis among physicians in training. It's something we've discussed before with some of our friends from Americans for Safe Access, some of the other doctors who've been on the program as well. And generally, in the past, we've talked about this and there just not being enough education or knowledge among practicing or training physicians. Is this just confirming what we've found in the past?
Sad but true. Even in a really, you know, prestigious, intriguing medical school in New Jersey, where you would hope that folks would be well informed, they're really showing that they just don't have the time or the specialization or the training that they need in order to provide good information about medical cannabis. And unfortunately, my student Rachel Luba just did a comparable study on folks who are working in hospice and like palliative care and end of life care. And I'm afraid we're really in the same boat. So medical schools and healthcare providers in general, we really need to step up and make sure that our healthcare providers learn more about cannabis in order to take advantage of its medical utility.
And I'm wondering also, does this show us in any way, I mean, we know the physicians don't know enough. Do the physicians know they don't know enough? Is this something physicians are clamoring for?
It looks like they're at least aware from these data that they aren't qualified. I thought it was intriguing because when you break it down by specializations, the pediatrics specialty folks and the obstetrician folks really are candid about not knowing enough. And I feel like they know for sure they haven't been trained and wouldn't be comfortable making recommendations or even talking about weighing the pros and cons. So I'm happy to say that those folks do. It's unfortunate that the other specialties may have received an hour or two of training and somehow think they got the lowdown when really they don't.
So a little knowledge being a dangerous thing there?
Sad but true. And knowing that you don't know is better than thinking you know when you don't.
Very good point. Is there any mechanism by which the medical the physicians may pressure the medical schools or find some way of providing a continuing education that would help alleviate this problem?
It is working out in a couple of states. I tried to get some of that off the ground out in California before I left. But when these start appearing on the board exams, when the tests you have to take in order to become a licensed MD, when the items show up on there, I'm sure everybody's going to really hop to it. But until then, there just aren't any big rewards for knowing it in the same sort of way you're rewarded for, you know, knowing how the cardiac system works or something like that.
Wow. It's just amazing to me that after, you know, 20 years of California medical cannabis and all these states that have doctors writing recommendations all across the country, the thought that they don't really know what they're writing recommendations for seems a little concerning.
Sad but true. There are other domains where they also really don't know. So a lot of folks get an MP without a lot of nutrition training, for example.
Okay.
And, you know, it's not what they're doing. So it's not what they need to know for licensure. So I can hardly blame them.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, as we usually say on this show, more education could definitely be in order here. Dr. Mitch Earlywine from the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Check them out at normal.org. And thanks again for joining us here on the Marijuana Agenda. Good luck on all your future studies.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com. We'll be right back.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville is brought to you by Cannabis Kamikaze, a professional licensed producer from Canada producing 3 pounds per light. Follow Cannabis Kamikaze on Twitter at Cannabis Kamikaze. That's at Cannabis, K-A-M-I-K-A-Z. Cannabis Kamikaze.
You're not high. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
This is high purity THC content marijuana, and it's not a healthy substance.
Okay, maybe you're a little high.
So my daughter has diplegia, cerebral palsy, which is sort of from the waist down, so her lower limbs don't work effectively. After age 2 and a half, she began to show signs of autism and self-injurious behavior. There are many families out there in other states that have similar situations, and they're using medical cannabis, and it's helping their symptoms. It's very difficult as a mom to know that there is a medication out there that is being used effectively in other states, and Texas isn't providing that for patients here. Medical cannabis could greatly improve the quality of life for my daughter. It is absolutely inhumane for lawmakers to keep medical cannabis from patients. Texans deserve better.
Health Cannabinoid, your ACMPR experts. Consultation services for medical cannabis. Visit healthcannabinoid.com or call 1-800-906-1383. That's www.healthcannabinoid.com or call 1-800-906-1383. Health Cannabinoid.
Total war against public enemy public number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am ill.
That was the point.
I think it would be a mistake to leave state.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
Don't smoke marijuana.
As we continue our fight to end adult marijuana prohibition, we keep going the legislative route. In the 8 states that have passed legalization so far, it's been through the initiative process. There are some 24 states that have that power in the United States for citizens to write their own laws, vote on them, and put them into the books. We're currently now looking at a couple of states, Vermont and New Jersey, as well as Connecticut and Rhode Island, I should say 4 states, that are looking at a legislative solution, that they may pass bills to legalize the adult use of marijuana. And one of the things we found throughout this process is it's an iterative process, very incremental, baby steps, it's called sometimes, an ounce of marijuana here and 6 plants there and so forth. Pot shops where you have limits and high taxes and all of that. But there's something about this fight that seems just a little bit off. And it first came to me months ago when I was watching an ABC miniseries. The miniseries was called When We Rise, and it was about the gay rights movement from about the Stonewall riot in New York in 1969. Through the 1980s and the AIDS epidemic, and all the way through the legalization of gay marriage. And as the story unfolds, there gets to be a point at which there's two competing philosophies within the gay rights movement. One of them is a philosophy of trying to present, put best foot forward and go through a legislative process in order to pass laws recognizing a civil right to homosexual acts, homosexual behavior, homosexual marriage, and so forth. That was one area, and that was the human rights campaign and people that wanted more of a button-down, suit-and-tie approach. The other approach was pioneered by the activists, the people working with ACT UP and other groups that were fighting the AIDS epidemic, who eschewed the idea of going through a legislative process and thought this was a fight for the courts. And there's a scene where this all comes down, and it involves Cleve Jones, the lead activist, and David Boies, the lawyer who was working with him. Now, David Boies, as an aside, was the lawyer who represented Al Gore in the infamous Bush v. Gore 2000 Supreme Court decision. So Boies in the scene, and I don't remember it exactly, but the gist of the scene was that Boies said, why should we be fighting to pass a law to get you a right you already have? And it's something you got to think about. And it took a minute to sink in, but he's right. By pursuing a legislative angle for marijuana legalization, we are somewhat ceding a point to our opponents that there should be a question as to whether or not marijuana should be legal or not, that it is not a fundamental right. Boies in the gay rights case was arguing that the Constitution already contains the right to gay marriage. It's already there. It's just that our system has failed to recognize it. Going the legislative route is not the way to recognize a right. It's going through the courts is where we recognize our rights. Now, that got me into thinking, and I've been thinking about this for months, about a fundamental right to cannabis. Now, in the past, you've heard me say this in a few rants. I've pointed out how there are two amendments that, to me, show us that two amendments plus the Declaration of Independence that show us that we have a fundamental right, not necessarily to just cannabis, but a fundamental right to plant seeds and sow crops. We have a fundamental right to plant crops and harvest the results. And I get this thinking from the Ninth Amendment to our Constitution. In our Bill of Rights, the Ninth Amendment says, the enumeration of certain rights within this Constitution is not meant to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Hope I'm pretty close to accurate on that from memory. A short amendment. And it's a precious amendment to me because what that amendment says, translated from 18th century ease, is that the people have a whole bunch of rights. We didn't write them all down. Just because we wrote a bunch of them down, freedom of press, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, no excessive bail, right to bear arms. We wrote a bunch of rights down, but that can't be all the rights, and it is not all the rights the people have. The fact that we enumerated a bunch of rights in this Constitution does not deny nor disparage other rights retained by the people. So what are these other rights retained by the people? Well, in my thinking, farming has to be one of those rights, at least at the personal level. Now, farming at the commercial level, obviously, invites the Commerce Clause of our Constitution. The federal government has the right to regulate the commerce between the states. And then, generally speaking, just commerce. So, if you're farming for yourself to feed your family off the land you own, what right does the government have to be involved in that whatsoever? And I looked also to our Declaration of Independence, which said, we believe that all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When any government so ordained fails to provide for that, it's up to the people to rebel, to claim their independence. But the important part of that phrase is, among these unalienable rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is, there are more. We are granted with unalienable rights that the government has no right to usurp or deny. So, If we have a constitution that was written by a bunch of hemp farmers in an agrarian society where you could pay your taxes in hemp, where it was mandated to grow hemp, how could farming not be an unalienable right? Consider also the history of this country, and I will, for the moment, put aside the genocidal and torturing and terrible parts, but just generally speaking, we had a Homestead Act that allowed white men to run out onto the plains into Oklahoma, into Oregon, all sorts of places, and just claim 160 acres of land. For what purpose? Well, to homestead, to farm and ranch and whatever else, but to farm. How could a country that's granting a Homestead Act not believe that a right to farm came with that? And certainly those men that went out and colonized the native lands, Native American lands, certainly started farming. They didn't ask for any government permission to do so. They didn't have to apply to the feds for any waiver to do that in the Oregon Territory. They just did it. Why? Because it's an unalienable right. It's a right. You got to think that the Founding Fathers would have thought it silly to have to write down the right to farm. Like, that's just so glaringly, obviously unalienable, you wouldn't even think to write it down. So that's always been my point. That's always been my belief, is that the Ninth Amendment and our heritage is really all we need, is really all the courts should need to recognize that personally we have the right to farm. And if you got a right to farm, it's no good unless you have the right to use the crops that you farm. Now, there are reasons why, constitutionally speaking, through a few court decisions, this has not been the case. Most recently, the Raich decision, which relied on the Wickard decision. Raich was from 2003. Wickard was from 1942, I think it was. What they boiled down to, the Wickard decision had to do with a farmer growing his own wheat during the wheat rationing of World War II, and the federal government decided, because the Commerce Clause regulates commerce, they were regulating the commerce in commercial wheat rationing. If someone grew their own personal wheat, they could violate their commercial ration with it because wheat's fungible. They could move some personal wheat into the commercial bin, blah, blah, blah. That same reasoning was used in the Raich case to deny a woman with brain cancer from using California medical marijuana to treat it, because they said, well, she could move her medical marijuana into the illegal market, even though she never did, and they didn't have to prove she would. The fact that she could was enough to say that it's Commerce Clause and we can ban it. But I say that's poppycock. That's ridiculous. How can the Commerce Clause ban something for which then there would be no commerce? If the commerce in something is banned, there is no commerce to regulate. It seems like it's a self-defeating proposition, which is actually the stance of our country up until about 1942. We had to have an amendment to ban alcohol because at that time, 1920, they didn't think there was a right to ban anything. You could regulate commerce, you couldn't ban stuff. But let me get back to the marijuana prohibition and the sex angle for a second before we go too far afield. Because I've always put my hope and my faith in this Ninth Amendment idea that we have an unalienable right to the production of cannabis. But as you look through, as I started this rant, we were talking about the gay rights movement and how that proceeded. If you look through that history, you'll find that indeed they had a bunch of cases that recognized unalienable rights that were not listed in the Bill of Rights. The first of these cases comes from 1965. It was Griswold v. Connecticut. And what this case was, there was a law in Connecticut that banned people from buying contraceptives, birth control. And it was challenged. And the Griswold case decided you couldn't ban people from getting contraception, married people at the time, from getting contraception, because it violated their fundamental right to privacy. Now, the Bill of Rights doesn't have a privacy clause. You look through the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, there's nothing in there about a right to privacy. But that's where Justice William Douglas, in the majority for Griswold, wrote that the right to privacy was found in the penumbras and emanations. Penumbras and emanations. Got to get my reading glasses for this one. Penumbras and emanations of other rights, such as the self-incrimination clause of the Fifth Amendment. So Justice Douglas was saying, look, they don't come right out and say there's a right to privacy. But in the Fifth Amendment, you got a right not to incriminate yourself. That means you have the right to keep a secret about yourself, which means that it's kind of implying you have a right to privacy, an implied right to privacy. And other justices agreed, but for different reasons. Justice Goldberg, he went with my belief, the Ninth Amendment. Justice Goldberg used the Ninth Amendment to say, no, you got a right to birth control because the Constitution doesn't ban birth control. And just because we didn't say you have a right to birth control doesn't mean you don't have a right to birth control. It's your right to privacy. Justice Byron Wright and Justice John Marshall Harlan II argued that privacy was a protected part of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Due Process Clause is the one that says states can't ban right laws that infringe on people's fundamental liberty, and they must recognize the rights that other states recognize. So we've got three different justifications, Fifth Amendment, Ninth Amendment, 14th Amendment, as to why we have a fundamental right to privacy that's not included in the Constitution. And this Griswold case, there was a case before it that was called Poe v. Ullman. And in the Poe case, the majority actually affirmed the government's right to ban birth control. And in the dissent, John Marshall Harlan II, who was, you know, one of the ones in this other, this Griswold case, in his dissent, he said, quote, "The full scope of liberty guaranteed by the Due Process Clause cannot be found in or limited by the precise terms of the specific guarantees elsewhere provided in the Constitution. This liberty is not a series of isolated points pricked out in terms of the taking of property, the freedom of speech and press and religion, the right to keep and bear arms, the freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, and so on. It is a rational continuum which, broadly speaking, includes a freedom from all substantial, arbitrary impositions and purposeless restraints." Think of that. Our freedom in America is a continuum, and the general principle underlying it is to be free from arbitrary impositions and purposeless restraints. Now, this Griswold case became a case that was cited for numerous cases having to do with privacy, the right to birth control for unmarried couples in Eisenstadt. They said, well, if married couples have a right, you can't deny that right to unmarried people. The right to abortion in Roe v. Wade had a lot to do with that Griswold decision. The right to contraceptives for juveniles at least 16 years old. And Lawrence v. Texas, the right to homosexual relations, the case that struck down anti-sodomy laws in Texas and other states. And from Lawrence v. Texas, we see other cases that were included as well. Cases that went on to legalize gay marriage, the Obergefell case. So if within the penumbras of the civil rights that are enumerated in our Constitution, through our Bill of Rights, through the amendments, through the Constitution itself, if within that there is a right to privacy that says you can do with your body, you can prevent it from possibly getting pregnant by using birth control, you can end a pregnancy through an abortion, you can choose to have sexual relations of any type with any other person of any other gender, if all of these things are considered unalienable rights, how is farming not an unalienable right? How is ingesting something you have farmed that may change your mood and body not an unalienable right? Now, our opponents would probably say, well, it's because we're talking about a substance and not an action. But I disagree. I think we are talking about a fundamental right that is guaranteed through our heritage, that is guaranteed by natural law. Absent stores, absent restaurants, where would the people, how would the people feed themselves?
they would farm. They would farm for themselves. It seems to me so self-evident at this point that our Constitution guarantees us a right to farm, that our Constitution guarantees us the right to do with our bodies what we choose with any substance nature provides. It seems so glaringly obvious to me now, it's hard for me to even conceive of why this is illegal. Hard for me to even believe we have to have this conversation. We'll continue with legalization through the legislatures, as that seems to be what's working so far. But at some point, some brave litigator, somebody with far payer high grade than pay grade than mine, far higher pay grade than mine, is going to have to tackle this constitutional issue. That's all the time we got. Thanks for joining us, folks.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
For everyone here at Delta 9 House and Studios, I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us.
And until next time,
take care of each other, tokers.
You're growing, you're trying, you're rolling, you're smoking. You take a seat, you plant it, you grow it, you're trying, you're rolling, you're smoking, and it goes down.